Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, September 16th, 2013. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live in the literal, but not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City, on this Matt and Michael Monday, we have a great show for you. We're going to break down the agreement between the Assad government, Russia, and the United States on chemical weapons. We're going to talk about Larry Summers bowing out of the race to be Fed chair. And
it's just too bad. It's just too bad.
Yeah, we're going to miss Larry.
Yeah, poor guy.
Big fans of Larry Summers here on the Majority Report, for his advocating dumping toxic waste in developing countries, to financial deregulation, to, of course, his opinion on women and science.
And after
we're
Mike,
huge fans of his.
And after Michael updates you on the news you missed this weekend, we will be talking with Allison Kilkenny of Citizen Radio on her piece for the Nation on basically an update about what Occupy activists have been up to the day before the two-year anniversary of Occupy Wall Street. 2 years ago tomorrow, September 17th, that's when the Occupy activists started camping out in Zuccotti Park in Lower Manhattan.
Yeah, and those Occupy activists may have had something to do with the fact that we won't have to bear Larry Summers as
yes,
chair.
Yes, that's very true. But they didn't do anything, Michael. They didn't. They had no goals, but somehow at the same time, they failed at reaching those goals they did not have.
With the exception of fighting income inequality, re-regulating Wall Street, getting rid of Larry Summers as Fed chair, and putting the most important pressing corporate accountabilities in the country on the front pages, what did Occupy ever accomplish? Yeah. What did they ever do for you?
So little.
It really is so little
in those 2 months.
It is that Life of Brian scene sometimes with the way people talk about Occupy Wall Street. Remember that scene in Life of Brian? That's in Life of Brian, right? What have the Romans ever done for us?
Yes.
The exceptions of the aqueduct and everything else. There's a little bit of that going on with Occupy. Allison's going to be joining us at about 12:30, so we're going to run through some stories first. Before we get to anything else, we're just going to give you two brief news updates. One thing is really horrible, and the other is a little bit of New York politics. But as probably many of you have...
That was nice.
I don't know how to – when you do a quick news update – because, you know, it's always so awkward when you hear, like, the traditional newscasts and they have, like, the announcer voice and are just like, meanwhile, in North Carolina, a woman was dragged and raped from in her vehicle and then killed and left in a swamp. And it's just this horrible story. And then they go, and the Bruins are doing well this weekend. They took an away game. And it's just this – and even on NPR – It's a different voice. It's just they never modulate anything. They're just like, 1,000 people were killed today in Syria. And new research on the Big Bang, you know, like in the NPR. So
Miley twerking. What's that all about?
I don't know if NPR is there yet, but I'm sure that's one of their social marketing strategists are trying to get them there. But at any rate, several people were killed this morning, and as many as 10 were wounded at a Navy Yard in Washington, D.C. It was basically a shooting spree. Apparently, the shooter has been killed right before we went on air, and I don't think a name has been released yet.
No, there's going to be a conference in about probably 15, 20 minutes, I heard.
Yeah, so, you know, that's ongoing. Obviously, it's a horrible story. We'll monitor it during
the latest
show.
Update is their Navy officials say at least 6 dead.
So it was some type of whether it was a some type of mass shooting. Obviously, we have no idea the motives or why. Awful, terrible story, and current news, so we just wanted to let you all know. By the time you listen to this podcast later, I'm sure a lot more information will emerge, but we will be updating it during the live show. And now I'm going to make that awkward transition, which I don't know how to make. But in New York City, Bill Thompson, who was the closest, the runner-up to Bill de Blasio in the mayoral primary, is dropping out, and de Blasio is now the official nominee. There's no real surprise there, but
it he hasn't done it yet.
He hasn't done it yet, but reports are that he's going to drop out today and clear the way for Bill de Blasio. Thompson didn't really have much of a chance, basically, in New York. There's a primary. If one candidate reaches 40%, there isn't a runoff. De Blasio has been at 40%. Thompson was saying he was going to hang in there until all of the votes are counted, but apparently something has changed, and apparently he's going to be bowing out of the race today. So it will be Bill de Blasio, Democrat, Joe Loda, the Republican. The Koch brothers are already dumping some money into the city. Here we go. Big New York race.
I don't see how in any sort of scenario we have a Republican mayor this time around.
You know, the thing with Joe Loda, you know, he's just an awful candidate. You know, he – I'm not on
paper. I just can't picture – I just can't – I especially can't picture New York voting for someone involved the way he was with the MTA.
Well, specifically, basically Joe Loda, really quickly, his background he has a Brooklyn working class background. Then he worked in finance, made a little bit of money, worked in the Giuliani administration, went back into finance, came back and was the head of the MTA, which, you know, for those of you outside of the city, that obviously that means he runs the subways. And the big thing is he's been responsible for pushing through a lot of fare hikes. And that is actually the kind of like epitome of the problem of the Bloomberg years, you know, which is that people who from the working class through many people who are in the middle or upper class, whatever, most working New Yorkers rely on the subway to get where they need to go. They're not getting cars, driving them to their place of work. They don't take a private helicopter from Long Island or Westchester like, you know, some people in or Connecticut. And those fare hikes really matter. The fiscal crisis, and it's not even been a fiscal crisis in New York, but any fiscal problems are always shifted. The burden of taxation is shifted on to working people, like something, like subway hikes, and Loda has been responsible for that. On top of which, he's just a terrible candidate. I mean, his acceptance speech, he gave an acceptance speech when he won the Republican primary, which bear in mind meant like, how many people voted in the New York City Republican primary?
Let's put it this way.
Yeah.
Anthony Weiner, who came in last with 4% of the Democratic primary,
right,
had more votes than Joe LaHoda, who won the Republican primary.
So this is like nobody's voting, and he gave a victory speech that sounded literally like something, and this is no offense to accountants here, but it sounded like something an accountant or some other professional who had never been involved in politics but had a strong fantasy life might deliver to himself in the shower, accepting like a fake nomination in his head. It was one of the most awkward, and it was just, you know, and it's clear, you know, he's going to try to run a fear-based campaign and try to put together the same coalitions that have kind of elected Republicans in New York City in the past, but we're just in a completely different time. And a lot of those appeals are out of date. I think de Blasio, vote, work on it. It really matters as an election. But, you know, I think he's going in with a, you know, very, very healthy chance of winning this election pretty comfortably.
Let's put it this way. If you dislike this certain individual as much as I do, Joe LaHoda has the backing of Rudy Giuliani.
Rudy.
And there's no one I dislike more.
Rudy Giuliani took a break from advocating for Serb nationalist ethnic cleansers with his lobbying group to cut a couple of ads for LaHoda. But anyways, that's actually true. That is what literally the type of thing that Rudy Giuliani's up to. So we'll get to this story first. So Larry Summers bowed out of the race for Fed chair yesterday. He had been apparently President Obama's top pick, it was looking like, to head the Fed. But there had been a strong pushback. And I think this is significant for a number of reasons. It's significant substantively, obviously, in terms of the policy implications of who's Fed chair. David Dane, Sam did a great interview with David Dane a couple of weeks ago explaining the real dangers of a Summers Fed chairmanship from a policy angle, given his previous track record. But it's also there's also a real political lesson here, in the sense that I think that this is the first time under the Obama administration that I can think of where the left, both through activists who organized against him, everybody from Occupy SEC, which Allison will talk about what she's on, to a variety of liberal and progressive groups in D.C. and grassroots groups and blogs like Daily Coast, and also a number of prominent populist senators who are on the Banking Committee, like Sherrod Brown, who drafted a letter supporting Janet Yellen, who was the other kind of top contender and the preferred choice of liberals, saying that he wanted Yellen, and a number of Democratic senators indicating that they would not support Summers. This is like the first liberal win on a major issue like that with the administration. This is one of the only areas I could think of where it wasn't centrist Democrats or right-wing Democrats or even a move to be conciliatory with Republicans that impeded something. It was progressives. And I think that that's important in and of itself, and it's indicative of some of the shifts that we've seen since the Obama reelection in the Democratic coalition. Obama himself, you know, we've had this conversation a million times, but he did campaign in a more populist way. He campaigned on a more a progressive message. And then we elected people like Elizabeth Warren, who are very genuine and robust economic progressives, and that matters. And they support people like Sherrod Brown and Bernie Sanders, who are already there, who are, have some genuine progressive politics. Secondly, and I think, you know, regardless of what, you know, Larry Summers has been very strategic. He writes columns in the Financial Times. He actually endorsed and wrote a really positive review of Mark Blyth's book on the dangers of austerity. Sam, of course, had him on several months ago. That's an amazing book. And Larry Summers wrote a really positive review of it for the Financial Times. So Summers is very savvy about positioning himself and kind of mitigating his weaknesses. But the reality of his record, as people from Joseph Stiglitz, among many others, have outlined, is deregulation, income inequality, and pushing not only and pushing deregulation globally, frankly, in both developing countries and in his role in the United States, and also as someone inside the administration who was not robust enough on Wall Street, who was not robust enough on the stimulus, and also someone who accepts the financialization of the economy, who really thinks that we can build prosperity off of a system of basically Wall Street-infused betting. So that's on the policy merits. Obviously, these are all the things that led to the crisis we're dealing with. So you don't want the guy who was an architect of the crisis to continue having a role in supposedly leading us out of the crisis. And number two, I think it's just important that someone who played such a formative role in those problems not continue to be rewarded with promotions, essentially. There's an important cultural message, at least there. I mean, you know, we've already talked, again, the endless non-criminal accountability of Wall Street. Let's at least have some cultural and career accountability. And I think that the left putting this pressure made that happen with Summers to a degree. Janet Yellen is kind of the preferred candidate of liberals. I think that that's more representative of the, you know, she's a woman. That's significant, especially given that that's been a problematic area from the Obama administration, and also highlighted by Summers' previous misogynistic comments when he was at Harvard. She's been, along with Bernanke, doing some things that are more, you know, some degree of monetary stimulus, far from perfect, but something. And she's also known as a consensus builder, and she's also perceived as someone who is not beholden to Wall Street. So those, that's the kind of preferred choice. The last thing I would add, this is, I thank God, they say he's not interested, but apparently the White House had reached out to Tim Geithner. Apparently he's not interested in the job. But I think Yellen will get it, and I think that that's probably the best case scenario.
Apparently, though, I was reading Obama is annoyed by the public advocating for Yellen.
I think that
– annoyed, whatever that means.
You know, I don't know. I mean, look, if he's annoyed by that, he should be annoyed by the incredible campaign that people inside the White House pushed for Summers, which was actually built inside the White House on undermining Yellen as an effective position for Fed chair. So if he's annoyed by that, he certainly should be annoyed by what they attempt to do to Yellen, questioning her competence, questioning her leadership capacity, even though she's by all accounts an incredibly brilliant, well-respected, experienced economist. And all of those kind of criticisms are, I mean, you know, the gender implications of those things are pretty obvious. Clearly Obama perceives some personal loyalty to Summers. And, you know, I think that there is a culture, obviously, in that White House where, look, Summers is a very, very smart guy. You read his columns, you see him speak, he's very, very bright. And if you have a certain type of very narrow conception of a type of intellect, a type of technical expertise that you perceive as being paramount and of utmost importance, figures like Summers are very seductive. But better he be annoyed than Summers be the next Fed chair. we'll see what happens, but that is a good step and a good political flex for the left. What kind of boggles my mind is just even in some respects, given the nature of the Democratic coalition, the gender stuff. What he said at Harvard as a president of a university was essentially said women are not really intellectually equipped to do math and science. And speaking as someone who isn't intellectually equipped to do math and science, I know. But I mean, it's just kind of mind-boggling and really, really, I'm surprised that wasn't more of an impediment is my point. Move on really quickly here to the news from Syria. So basically, they've struck a deal, Russia and the Syrian regime, the United States. Syria's agreed to sign a chemical weapons convention, and it's also agreed to give up its chemical weapons stockpiles sometime in 2014. I think there are a couple of takeaways here. One is, I think the Obama administration does deserve some credit for allowing a diplomatic path to emerge. And also, I know there's many conflicting interpretations of John Kerry's comment where he sort of floated this publicly. Some people thought it was I know the Daily Show did a really funny rundown that it was like a Dr. Magoo moment. I know that, or Captain Magoo, excuse me, that
Mr. Magoo?
Mr. Magoo.
Yes.
I don't even know what that reference.
It's. I'll explain to you later.
Explain it to me later. I was homeschooled, folks. I'm sorry. Other people have said, and I think Sam was hinting at, in some respects, even with Kerry and his kind of mishap sometimes, he is a smart guy. It seems kind of unlikely that that would completely emerge from nowhere, especially given how quickly the Russians were able to seize on it. Now, Assad is still basically threatening, there's questions around implementation of that because he wants us to stop funding the rebels, which we're not going to do. And frankly, I don't think we necessarily should do. I think we should be providing some help to some of the rebels. That's my personal view, and certainly doing more to deal with the refugee crisis. But we'll see how that plays out. But I think that, there's a couple of kind of contextualizing things to look at that. The deal through. One is that the reality that we are living in a more multilateral world. And whether or not it's Russia, I think Russia obviously has its own – Assad is its – that's its client regime. That's its interest in Syria. There's a lot of client-state relationships in Syria and a lot of different interests being expressed through that. Russia is Assad's prime backer. Russia also has its own some legitimate strategic concerns, but also incredibly, deeply problematic human rights record with Muslims, with what they've done in Chechnya. They perceive Syria probably through those lenses. But it's definitely a victory for them diplomatically, and I agree with President Obama. So what? Fine. Let it be a diplomatic victory for whoever if it achieves the objective. It's also a victory, though, broadly for countries that are different than Russia. I would make a distinction the BRIC countries, countries like Brazil, countries like South Africa, and China were involved to a degree because they, for a variety of different reasons, want to see more deal-making like this happen. And they want to live in a world, frankly, of deal-making. And it sounds kind of obvious, and it sounds something like we all sort of pay lip service to, but I think that this is a – there's a convergence here of the kind of exhaustion of U.S. capacity, both in terms of at home and exhaustion with endless military engagement and intervention, and globally with the kind of coalitions coming together to facilitate this type of deal making. Now, I don't think that this doesn't address the human rights crisis in Syria. This doesn't address the civil war. And frankly, it may not even address fully the chemical weapons question, because one of the reasons Assad has used chemical weapons is because he's representing, you know, his forces have only been able to keep up with the rebels through these kind of massive, shocking uses of force, not just chemical weapons, but also carpet bombing and really brutal campaigns, which specifically punish civilians in cities and in areas where rebels have taken over. The other thing that really briefly, Parag Khanna, who's a foreign policy analyst and geostrategist and wrote a piece recently talking about how the real way to look at what's happening in the Middle East is that you have these kind of three players moving for dominance in that region. So right now you have on one hand in Turkey, you have the Justice and Development Party, which is a more centrist Islamic party, but it tends to be aligned with Muslim Brotherhood politics and with a certain flavor of Islamic democracy. They've been incredibly supportive of the rebels in Syria. They were supportive of the Morsi government. And they want to project a Turkish influence in their specific flavor through the region. And it's a different type of Turkish influence. The previous regime had been obviously much more secular. The Gulf states and the Saudis are supporting not Islamist movements so much. They're supporting some Islamist movements in Syria, but in other places, like in Egypt, they're backing the military coup. They want stability. They want the old line alliances to work. And Iran is filtering the situation through Shiite identity and nationalism, and that's why they're in Bahrain, which is another area. Bahrain is a Sunni monarchy that has a very large Shia population that are oppressed. So the Saudis sent in troops to back the monarchy in their crackdown, and the Iranians support the human rights movement in Bahrain, whereas in Syria, the Iranians have backed Assad. Assad's not Shia, but Assad is Alawite, and they're more closely aligned with the Shias. And of course, Syria is a transport route for Iran to get weapons and other resources into Hezbollah. So there's just a lot of moving pieces. And I think that one of the lessons that we need to keep drawing is, you know, in the 1970s, when Jerry Brown was the governor of California the first time, he talked about living in an era of limits. And I think we need to start thinking about foreign policy somewhat in those terms. Where can we really intervene to help actual people, to deal with actual humanitarian crisis? And then, you know, think more broadly about finding solutions to these problems. But that's where things stand now. The process is going to go through the UN, and obviously the administration is still holding out the threat of military force. So that's where things stand.
It's a tenuous situation. I mean, I don't know how else to describe it.
Yeah, it's a very tenuous situation.
It's difficult, and it's not as cut and dry, black and white as people would like it to be.
There's all of these things. There's the issue of borders. There's the issue of, you know, I mean, we've highlighted all of these issues. I think it's interesting to look at the Syrian anarchists, which I've talked about before. I think it's important to look at the Kurdish population in all of these places. There's just a lot of variables, and, you know, that's kind of the thing that I think it sounds so obvious, but as, you know, as citizens who care about this stuff and as people and, you know, sounds a little new agey, but just as, you know, sharing humanity, sharing this planet, right? And then also as policymakers and journalists and whatever, you really got to – it's almost like we need to all start thinking more like anthropologists or something. Like we just need to start figuring out like who are people, what, how are they living, what are their communities, what are their values, how do they look at the world. And we want to look at all these places and have one map and one simple story that kind of filters everything. And, you know, it's almost never the case. And then it leads to, you know, in the worst case, a disaster like Iraq. But, you know, and then obviously there's all the other factors of pipeline politics and oil and climate change. You just keep kind of like loading the factors in, and it gets more and more complex. But that's how it is. I mean, that's what it is. Is there any – I know we're going to get to Allison in just a moment. Is there any new news on the shooting?
Yes. It appears that they are looking for two additional shooters wearing military-style uniforms.
Wow.
So there's one shooter dead. I mean, this is just – these are two suspects.
No, and this is – and this has happened in a lot of these recent shootings where there's usually been – some type of speculation, somebody else is involved.
So there could be one more, there could be two more, there could be zero more.
Right.
We just don't know yet.
Mm-hmm. And they haven't released any more information about the guy that they killed?
No, not yet.
Okay. All right. Well, that's terrible. Incredibly depressing. Go ahead.
Regardless of whether it's just a mass shooting, just whatever, let's do a shooting today. It's like, you know, how some people just...
Or a terrorist attack. Whatever, yeah.
I'm sure the NRA will find some way to spin this so that they take no responsibility for the danger of their gun laws.
See,
and
if
guns.
The military had more guns, because what happens is when you go on a base, you need to clean your guns, and that's...
I'm sure they're hard at work writing something. I'm sure.
They are like...
It happened in D.C.! That's what they'll say. Something like that. Like, oh, the most strictest.
The soldiers were, like, corrupted by the gun control of the city. And that, like, hurt their ability to use guns. That's what happened.
See, when you take our rights, our gun rights away, it makes us want to shoot you. That's what, maybe that's what they'll spin.
That might be the most honest thing they've ever said. See, they'd be like, see, when we convince ourselves of a fantasy story in our own weird little headspace, then we freak out, and then we do stuff. You know, if the NRA built an ad campaign around that, I would be horrified by it, begrudgingly respect it. I'd be like, wow, at least that seems sort of honest.
Who's their
terrifying,
who's
but
their,
honest.
Who's their new ad agency? They must be rolling in money right now.
I wonder, actually, it would be an interesting thing to find out who. I found out the public relations firm that reps the government of Russia and got Putin's newspaper placed in the New York Times.
Oh, yeah, I heard about this. I forgot their name.
They're Ketchum.
Ketchum, yes.
And they also, people will remember them from the Bush administration because they were involved in these, in paying pundits to advocate for Bush, I think it was education policies.
Ah.
So they have a very distinguished record from Bush to Putin.
Maybe they too saw the what was it that Bush said? Like, I looked deep down inside and I saw the soul in his. What was it that he said? Sam always says it and I can't remember the exact thing now. When Bush met Putin and looked into his
eyes. I looked into his eyes and saw his soul.
So
he's a good man.
I really just wanted you to do the Bush voice.
And it was good, you know.
Can we get an Obama saying, like, I listen to Putin's eyes and I don't see what Bush saw. I don't see.
as with many other things that the previous occupant of my office saw, whether it was the opportunity to build a G.I. Joe, a life-size G.I. Joe fort in the Rose Garden, or other things he was invested in doing, I didn't always... see things in particularly the same way that he did. So when I saw Putin, I don't know. I saw synapses, I saw retina, and frankly, kind of a hard on. Truth be told, look.
All right, we'll be back.
Okay, we'll be right back with Allison Kilkelly.
All right, we are back on the Majority Report. It is Matt and Mike Monday, and I'm joined by my co-producer, Michael Brooks. I am Matt Binder. And joining us on the phone now, from Citizen Radio, it's one of the co-hosts and also contributing writer to The Nation, Allison Kilkenny. Allison, thank you for joining us. Wait, I'm sorry. Hold on 1 minute. Let's start from the beginning. Joining us now on the phone from Citizen Radio and contributing writer for The Nation, ladies and gentlemen, Allison Kilkenny. Allison, thank you so much for joining us. Hello, thank you.
Yeah, of course. I aspire to be Sam one day so I can not do my own podcast and just have other people guest host it.
And let them deal and let them deal with the tech issues you leave behind.
Yeah, I felt so bad, but thank you for making it work. I'm glad I get stuck.
If it was anyone else, maybe I would have been like, you know, Michael, bring my volume up a bit. If it was anyone else, maybe I would have been like, you know what, we'll just have to cancel. But I had to persist that we do this for Allison Kilkenny. All right, so
I appreciate it.
Thanks, Allison.
Let's get right to it. So, Allison, you wrote this great piece for the Nation called Occupy Activists' New Fight for Regulation, Affordable Housing, and Social Justice. And in it, you basically talk with a bunch of different Occupy, what was originally, I guess, occupied all these working groups. And then these working groups basically broke off, and it seems like they've each turned into their own full-fledged activist group.
Yeah, that's right. And one of the central criticisms of Occupy Wall Street, remember, was that they were too scattered, too disorganized, they weren't focused enough. But ironically, these working groups that are doing really focused work right now aren't receiving a lot of media attention. So they finally are doing what everyone wanted them to, and like suddenly the media is not interested anymore.
Of course.
So the two groups that I focus on, there are so many great subgroups doing work, and this was by no means meant to represent all of them, but Occupy the SEC and Occupy Our Homes are both doing amazing work. And also there's another group that I didn't get to profile just because of a length issue, but Strike Debt is doing amazing work too. But Occupy the SEC are involved in court cases, like very specific things. And it's a very wonky group. It's extremely focused. It involves people who really know their stuff, forwards and backwards. And really the media isn't paying attention to them. And then there's the direct action arm of Occupy Our Homes, where they're like physically keeping people in their homes, people that would have been kicked out by the bank.
Let's pause for a second. Let's discuss, actually. I want to sort of go into each one a little bit. So let's first discuss what Occupy the SEC is up to, because like you said, they seem to be the wonkier branch of the Occupy movement. And what they're doing is really interesting. I mean, if you want to see, actual results from action, I guess people, critics of Occupy constantly on that front have complained. I mean, I see it from Occupy the SEC. You can see what they're doing, like physically see what they put together.
I think the reason people sort of face that with Occupy the SEC is it's super wonky stuff.
Yeah.
So, like, for example, they recently submitted an amicus brief in the Supreme Court's consolidated choice cases that basically it's based on the massive Ponzi scheme perpetrated by Alan Stanford and relates to the complicity of third parties like auditors and law firms in abetting fraud. So that's, like, one thing they're working on. But I think if you start to, like, say that, people sort of get, like, their eyes start to glaze over, But there's another one where they filed a lawsuit in the Eastern District of New York against six federal agencies over their delay in implementing a final rulemaking in connection with the Volcker Rule. This is basically just a specific section of Dodd-Frank meant to restrict the banks from making certain kinds of really shady investments that don't benefit customers. So this was just them saying, hey, you're supposed to be doing this right now. Like, this was actually implemented to stop another meltdown, and you're not doing the thing they passed. Like, one of the minor things they passed not to let this happen again, and you're not even doing that. So Occupy the SEC has sort of become, like, a watchdog group. They really know, like, finance, and they really understand the laws, and they're basically watching these huge financial firms just saying, are you doing even the little things that you're supposed to be doing right now? And if you're not, we're going to, you know, try to create a lawsuit against you or participate in a lawsuit that already is standing against you. And this is all happening in courtrooms, and it's really not receiving media attention.
Mm. Well, of course. I mean, apparently, unless you're camped out in a park, apparently the media doesn't pay attention to you.
Yeah, and it's very ironic, and, like, having covered it from the beginning, it's like you sort of are, you know, frustrated on behalf of the protesters because I heard so many times, like, why don't they get serious about, like, specific legislation? Why don't they get more focused in their approach? And it's like the second they did that, it sort of seemed to lose its romantic general appeal for the media. The media loved it when it was just, like, a revolution, right?
Yeah.
They were, like, I mean, they couldn't get enough of it.
The criticism in that aspect is sort of like, why isn't this protest group like all the other protest groups? Like, why aren't this activist group doing what all the other activist groups do? I mean, that's why they got the media attention. Yeah, because they weren't.
So what's really ironic about that is if the media wants that direct action appeal, like if they really like the dramatics of people getting arrested, follow Occupy Our Homes, you know? There was just a bunch of them just got arrested in Washington, D.C. They were down the street from Covington and Brewing, and they were arrested for blocking, a revolving door. And there were women and grandmothers getting arrested. It was, like, super dramatic. And again, like, media was nowhere to be found.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about Occupy Our Homes now. I mean, if there's any group out there that's, I mean, to me, what they do is actually, at least in the short term, more important than whatever the critics of Occupy Wall Street were looking for Occupy to do. I mean, Occupy Our Homes is literally saving people's homes. They're literally stopping these people from becoming homeless. They're stopping their homes from being foreclosed on and taken away from them. Like, literally physically stopping it from happening. And there are people who are still living in their houses because of Occupy Our Homes. And if not because of Occupy Our Homes directly, because of what Occupy Our Homes is doing to try to teach the direct action and how to do this yourself.
Yeah. So if Occupy the SEC isn't your thing, if it's too cerebral and you're like, yeah, but what is Occupy doing on the ground?
That's totally me, by the way.
The examples I always give are Occupy Our Homes and Occupy Sandy. Occupy Sandy was another great offshoot of Occupy Wall Street that sort of filled this vacuum when FEMA and the Red Cross were nowhere to be found after Hurricane Sandy in New York City. Occupy Sandy stepped in and did really meaningful, on-the-ground, tangible things to help people, to the point where Michael Bloomberg, the National Guard, and the New York Times actually had to acknowledge that, you know, Occupy Sandy had done good work, and I know they really hated having to admit that, but, like, it was universally accepted that Occupy Sandy did good things. And Occupy Our Homes, sort of similarly to Occupy the SEC, has been working diligently. These great organizers have been working for 2 years, longer than that, because they have been doing this stuff before Occupy Wall Street. Like, Atlanta and Minnesota are two of the biggest examples where, in Atlanta especially, they've racked up multiple victories with individual homeowners, including Jacqueline Barber, retired police detective and cancer survivor, who's facing eviction. They kept her in her home. And that's just, like, there's so many examples. Occupy Our Homes
so much,
is really
so much
offshoot from, like, there's so much happening, I can't even, like, begin to summarize it.
So much for the meme that Occupy lost its direction and just became an anti-police movement with that one. I mean, I'm pretty sure I've heard another story about them saving former police officers' houses before.
Yeah. I mean, just to give you another example, Occupy Homes Minnesota, also another chapter that's won multiple victories. They kept Rose McGee, who's a community advocate, who was fighting Fannie Mae for a year and was finally able to get a victory when she got the backing of Occupy Minnesota. And it included a principal reduction. So that in that case, it was actually the bank saying, like, doing what you think the bank would want to do in every case, which is we're still going to take payments from you, so we're still going to get money, but we're going to negotiate with you so you can stay in your house versus we're going to kick you out of the house and not get any money. Like, it made sense for Rose. It also made sense for the bank.
Oh, of course, yeah. That's, I mean, it's amazing to me. Before I get to that, let's just quickly a little bit more about Occupy Sandy. I mean, they literally were in like in these areas that were destroyed by Hurricane Sandy when Red Cross and FEMA were nowhere to be found. I mean, the fact that you have people like Mayor Bloomberg having to even mention that Occupy Sandy was helpful. I mean, that in itself should speak volumes.
Yeah, it was a really amazing moment, and Occupy Sandy was a little criticized by, like, other organizers because they had all of this amazing popular support and momentum, and they were being good people, and they were actually being very classy, but what ended up happening was they didn't really advertise that this was an Occupy Wall Street thing. They were just handing out supplies, they were handing out blankets, they were helping people, but they weren't saying, like, brought to you by Occupy. So a lot of people really never associated them with it, and I think they lost a little bit of, even though Michael Bloomberg was like, this is amazing, thanks for doing this, it seemed like a scattered group of individuals just decided to come together in the wake of a storm, and that's really what it was, but it was also Occupy Sandy. I mean, this was an Occupy Wall Street thing. And I don't think a lot of people understood that that's what it was. And then also they had problems, you know, sort of moving from a direct action on the ground thing to like a political movement. And they tried. There were a couple protests, you know, outside Mayor Bloomberg's East Side townhouse in order to call attention to hurricane ravaged areas, still waiting for vital repairs. But it never really picked up the same amount of momentum that Occupy Wall Street did, and that might be because New York City was just, you know, in chaos. I mean, the poor areas were, after Hurricane Sandy, and, like, it was just not the right environment for a movement like that. But it petered out. It never really became, and they were, like, trying to figure out, like, can this be, like, a climate change thing? Can this be, you know, Tale of Two Cities thing where we bring attention to poverty and the fact that, you know, poor people still don't have their lights on, but Wall Street's power came back on within, like, hours?
Yeah, certain areas were just ignored for people who aren't aware. Just certain areas were just, like, they weren't even part of the city, even though they obviously are. I mean, it's just nothing there for them there was no action done by the city or Red Cross or FEMA for areas like the Rockaways and parts of Brooklyn, Staten Island.
Yeah, and I should mention Occupy Sandy. It's still, like, doing, charity work right now. I just got an email from them about their update, their two-year update. But, like, there's still ravaged areas of the city that still need help, and Occupy Sandy is still there, and the Red Cross and FEMA are not there. So this is still happening.
And I want to get to one that you did not get a chance to mention in your article. I think I saw that you said that they just didn't get back to you in time for the article's run. But Strike Debt, the Rolling Jubilee.
Yes. So the Rolling Jubilee is, again, you know, part of being an activist group is you have to capture the imagination of the people. And the Rolling Jubilee is really brilliant because I think it's a really easy to understand concept for people where essentially when you have debt, that debt can be sold on something that's pretty much like a black market, and people can buy your debt and sell it for a much higher price. So the Rolling Jubilee was Strike Debt's way to say, okay, we're going to participate in this market, and we're going to raise money from people, and we're going to take that money and buy a whole lot more debt with it. So, for example, they've raised like $615,000, and they've been able to purchase $12 million worth of debt, and then they abolish it. They turn around and they burn it. And then they, like, contact people, and they, you know, give them the notice where they say, that money you owed, it's gone. Occupy Wall Street, Strike Debt took care of it. And this is really, like, kind of a Robin Hood thing, right? You know, like, when you get a notice like that in the mail, it's like, holy crap, you can do that, you know? And I think it captured that romantic appeal that Occupy Wall Street had to a lot of people, where it's like these people are perceived as heroes by a lot of communities, and because they're taking this really corrupt system and using it to their benefit. Now, a lot of people have also criticized that because they said the issue is that system. You shouldn't participate in the system that exploits, you know, people's debt. But Strike Debt's answer to that is sort of, this is what we're dealing with right now. We're going to use the system to our advantage, and we're going to abolish a lot of debt.
And I believe they what was it? They abolished $1 million of medical debt in where was it? Do you recall? I think Kansas.
Yeah.
That's I mean that I know the criticism you just brought up, but I mean to me that's something that you cannot look at that, and you cannot look at $1 million of medical debt wiped away from people who were stuck with this, who had it hanging over them. You can't call that nothing. I don't see how you can say Occupy didn't do anything, because right there is just one example of Occupy doing something from one of the offshoots.
Yeah, I agree that, like, for individual people, obviously that is very meaningful. I mean, how awesome would that be to get something in the mail that says, this thing that was really scary to you is no longer an issue. But at the same time, it also draws attention to this debt black market. It also draws attention to the fact that people are going bankrupt from, you know, trying to afford medical care. It draws attention. It simultaneously helps people, and it draws attention to how corrupt our economic system is. And that seems, at least to me, like a win-win for Occupy Wall Street. Like, they get to look like the good guys, and they're also saying, you know, this is why we originally, you know, occupied Zuccotti Park. We're in opposition to this thing that still exists.
I mean, to me, that's the main thing for at least to me. I mean, there were a lot of times when Occupy was, you know, September to the end of November 2011, early December 2011, where you really felt like, wow, this what's going to go on with this movement. But I mean, looking back, I mean, there's a lot of ways where the best thing this movement did was literally just raise the awareness. Like, if that's all it did, then it succeeded on every single level. I mean, that's just to me, actually.
Yeah. It's gotten harder for them to do that, obviously, since the camps have all been crushed by the police for the most part. And that's another thing that, like, I feel like I should emphasize anytime I get a chance. Like, people are like, oh, Occupy died because everybody got bored and they went home. And it's like, no, the police crushed the movement.
Yeah,
like, they physically came in and, like, crushed the camp and took the tents down and beat the protesters until they left. That is what ultimately, there was a profile, I think it was in the New York Daily News, about the protesters who tried to go to trial and, like, oppose their arrests and oppose the police practices. And the legal system has literally crushed their will. Like, they've had to drop their lawsuits because they have jobs and, like, they have lives and they can't keep coming into Manhattan to, you know, object to the same court case for now it's been 2 years since some of the arrests. And, like, it's enlightening, but it's also kind of like, man, it's disheartening because these are the people who are actually like, no, I want to go to trial. I actually want to oppose what happened to me. And it just could not happen for a lot of them.
I just want to bring that you brought that up. I just want to briefly bring up another piece that ran in the Nation this past week by Nathan Schneider called "Breaking Up with Occupy," and in it he just spoke with a number of Occupy activists, and it seemed like a lot of them just wanted to move on from Occupy. Like, they felt like it was just a dead name. They wished that the newer groups wouldn't use the Occupy name. One of the guys from Adbusters, Micah, I believe his name is, called Occupy a constructive failure. For those who aren't aware, Adbusters is the group that originally called for Occupy Wall Street even before September 17th. So I just wanted to bring that up, how some Occupy activists seem to be a little bit just out of the Occupy name. They just don't even want to really associate with it because they feel like maybe take what we learned from Occupy, take what we took from Occupy, and just move on to different activist groups.
Yeah, and I think that's the whole idea behind Strike Dead. Strike Dead obviously doesn't have the Occupy in its name. But I love anytime Adbusters weighs in on something, because I never once ran into anybody from Adbusters during an Occupy Wall Street protest. And I don't know anyone who ever has, but they still claim that they started the movement. I actually know a lot of activists as well who have gone on to do stuff like with the striking fast food workers, a lot of non-union collective action stuff, and, you know, they don't show up to these places, like, parading the Occupy banner. They're just sort of carrying the spirit with them, and I think that's the main takeaway, that, you know, we need to move away from the Occupy is dead narrative, because the spirit that birthed that movement is still with us. If anything, the class divide has gotten worse. since 2 years ago. You know, things are not better, and those grievances don't magically go away. If you were buried under student debt 2 years ago, you're still buried under that debt. You're still mad about it, and you're still scared, and you're looking to channel that energy into something. And there are a lot of great organizers, a lot of really young, passionate people involved in the Occupy Wall Street movement, and I'm still in contact with a lot of them, and they're still doing organizing.
You know, interesting. I'm sorry, continue. I'm sorry.
Oh, well, the problem is it's not centralized under a banner, so it's very easy for the establishment media to say, it's gone now. Mm, and yes. That's a real misunderstanding of what activism even means. But, it's not surprising that the media has framed it that way, but it's just incorrect.
It's interesting you bring up the food strike, the fast food strikers, and, other groups Defend the Dream, because I really do feel like I remember. I mean, I was in high school, early college in the early to mid 2000s, and I was interested in activism. I was definitely aware of things going on, but other than like maybe the anti-war movement, no real activist group was really able to grab the media. And I feel like since Occupy, I feel like Occupy was the first one to really do so since then. And since Occupy, I feel like the media has given, actually, a lot more, still little, but a lot more than they would have before Occupy, to movements like, you know, the Dreamers and the fast food workers. I really do feel like Occupy at least forced the media to cover these movements as little as they do, but still better than nothing.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, the media was criticized a lot for not taking seriously, for being very belittling about Occupy Wall Street. And at least, like, the so-called lefty media, like MSNBC at least, you know, more left than, like, say, CNN, did respond to that, where, like, now they, you know, they do cover fast food strikes. But it always takes, like, you know, real serious on-the-ground organizing and good alternative media to first get the establishment media interested in it. And by the way, I want to add that Occupy Wall Street always lends, like, in most cases, a sort of secondary solidarity role to a lot of these organizational efforts. Because the fast food strikers, I mean, that's 100% the workers. They have been fighting for this for so long and organizing really bravely and putting their jobs on the line. And if former occupiers show up to lend solidarity, that's great. But what I'm really glad that Occupy has never done is try to, like, take, you know, credit for that and say, oh, well, we, you know, what we did in Zuccotti inspired the workers, and, like, that really gave them courage. And maybe that is true, but, you know, the workers are really on the front lines here, and it's nice to see people show up sort of anonymously and not say, like, Occupy has arrived, and, like, try to feel the thunder of the moment.
Oh, I agree completely, yeah. I mean, I really do think, I mean, this is the we're on the eve of the second anniversary of Occupy. I'm speaking with Allison Kilkenny. She wrote this great piece in The Nation called Occupy Activists' New Fight for Regulation, Affordable Housing, and Social Justice. And I do think the Occupy movement will be – I mean, I really do think we're going to be hearing about Occupy for a long time to come. I think all the next big movements, the next big activist groups, the next big activists who you will hear about and who will create real change, I do think – when they discuss what sparked them or what got them interested, I do think you'll hear some of these people who are now young in their teens, 20s, 30s. I really do feel like years from now you will hear them say, you know, the Occupy movement sort of sparked my interest in these sorts of things. And if that there, and it's again, that's another Occupy success.
I agree.
Allison Kilkenny of Citizen Radio. Radio, wow. That's wearecitizenradio.com. I'm almost like out of it because of those technical difficulties, but this was a great interview. Thank you so much for staying with us while we fix these difficulties. It was Allison stayed with us for a very long time, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right, take care, Allison.
All right, thanks, guys.
Thanks, Allison.
Whoa. That was a great interview, and I can't thank her enough because I was completely out of it.
Yeah, that was really intense.
What happened was, I wanted to explain what happened here.
Well, really really quick, I think we will, should we make this a freebie show?
No, we're not going to, because Sam will be very angry. We're not going to make this a freebie show.
All right.
we're gonna cut out the that was we tw- there was we're gonna cut out 20 minutes and it won't be a freebie show.
It was 20 minutes
it
that
was
that 20 went on
minutes
for?
That went on for, yes.
Jesus.
So we're gonna go to the better half of the show. We will discuss what happened with my technical difficulties in the better half. Support this show by becoming a member.
Oh, wait, really quickly, before we talk about all the things you could do to support the show, which you must, the app is coming on Thursday.
Yes.
The app is available.
And the app will fix all technical difficulties because we won't have to worry about, well, not all, but very many of them, because you won't have to worry about certain things going down and so forth, because the app's got it all down.
This app is amazing. It's so easy to use. This is no exaggeration. This is just the straight truth from me and from other friends that I've had experiment on this app. A lot of people, I assume, like a lot of people listen to the show, probably have other apps that they use for news, music, whatever. This app is so easy. You go there, you just scroll down. You can find any – you search terms. You can find any show you want in the New Majority Report. It couldn't be easier to use. You get push notifications. You can take it with you. Wherever you go, obviously. This app is amazing. It's going to be available on Thursday, and we want to push it to the top downloads in its category in the Apple Store. So that's big news. Thursday, the long-awaited and totally living up to its best promises, Majority Report app will be available, which is another great reason why you should become a member of the Majority Report. Which you can do so by going to the Majority Report homepage and clicking Become a Member. It is an incredibly easy process. You can support us by buying your Amazon purchases through our Amazon link. Also on the Majority Report homepage, go to justcoffee.coop to buy fair trade coffee that also supports the Majority Report. Sam definitely invested a lot in this app. It's worth every penny in terms of its quality, but we need the support.
Yes, we do. We're going to go into the better half now. You could, I don't know if you could call into this show, to be honest.
Yeah, you know what? We're gonna not deal with
that
IMs. Today. We're going to do IMs.
Do IMs. Call IM us through the app or majority.fm at jobber.org. We will read your longer IMs today in lieu of the phone calls, so feel free to type up a storm. And yeah, Sam will be back tomorrow. Hopefully, we will fix this issue with the interviews. And
we'll be right back in the better half.
Right back. Happy birthday, Romina.